about something, or if you have doubts about what to do next, drop by at any point. So I was asked to teach you a course on some basics, basic material on mathematics and Mathematica, which hopefully will fill some gaps that you might have and help you not struggle during the other courses. So what I will cover in mathematics will be complex analysis, what I will review mostly, and group theory. So my assumption is that most of what I will tell about complex analysis will be a review. This is what I hope, that this will be mostly a review for you. I hope that all of you have had a course on complex analysis. Is it true? And I will assume that group theory, it will be roughly 50% review. I assume that you know the basics of group theory, you have heard a bit, you have encountered it in a way or another, maybe not in a very formal way, but you have some notions about some things about group theory. So I will have in mind that some of these things are new for you. And concerning Mathematica, I will assume that it is completely new. And I will assume that you know nothing about Mathematica, and you don't know that you must click Shift Enter to compute 1 plus 1, which I think it might be true. So okay, but in any case, just to help me tune the pace of the lectures and the kind of material that I will present, at the end of each lecture, I will hand you a small survey where I ask you whether it was too fast or too slow and too advanced or too trivial, and this will help me gauge and fine-tune it. So just to motivate what I'm going to describe, I think it's very fair to say that basically all results in theoretical physics, or I can put an almost before all, but all results in theoretical physics, all non-trivial results are non-trivial because they are using in a smart way complex analysis. And it's basically our only tool to generate non-trivial results and to generate powerful results is to explore the complex plane. And when some result doesn't look, and when some result, okay, so either the results are non-trivial because we are using complex analysis, or they look non-trivial because we don't know enough group theory. And if we would, then we would realize that those results would be just symmetry. So both complex analysis and group theory are extremely powerful tools. In learning complex analysis is easier. And the amount of language that we need to develop, the kind of vocabulary that we need, it's not as extensive as the one in group theory. So in group theory, we'll have to introduce many more definitions. And it's important for us to develop a language that we can all speak. And it's important for you to know many concepts, what are their names, etc. So, of course, in group theory, it will be slightly more abstract. And if you know nothing about group theory, it might be useful for you to read a bit of Georgi or Jones' Introduction to Group Theory, maybe even during the weekend, just to warm up a bit for what will follow in the second week, where I will cover mostly group theory. My goal is to try to start covering group theory by the end of this week, but it might be too optimistic, so I don't know. Okay, so if you want to have some goal to prepare for the next week, for example, you can try to Google and use Wikipedia and try to understand what is, for example, the adjoint representation of SU3, for example. So to understand what this is, you will have to study to understand many things in between before that. So if you arrive at understanding what is the adjoint representation of SU3 before next week, you will be in a very good shape to follow more easily what I'm going to describe you. I will, of course, tell you what is the adjoint representation, but it's useful if you already try to struggle and to arrive there in your own means. Okay. Any question before we start? It's a bit extremely cold here. I cannot be here because of the air conditioning. Is it possible to? I see. Because I won't write here, but I come here and I am hit by this cold wave. Okay. So suffer a bit while I'm on this board, and then I'll go to that one, and you can put it again extremely cold, and then I come here and we turn it off again. Okay, so let's start by considering some contour integral around some region like this. And we want to consider then this contour integral of some function on this curve of S. Okay. This is some curve gap. Now, I want to consider two particular integrands. I want at each point of this curve to consider the tangent unit vector and the normal unit vector. So let's call it t and n. Okay. And I will be interested in two particular f of s's. We are interested in f of s, which is the normal component of some field vector. So we have some f, which is defined at any point of this curve, which is defined at any point in space-time, dot the normal vector, and we might be interested in the inner product of s with the tangent vector. Well, let's consider these two situations here. Let's call it A and B. Okay? So when we consider A, the name for this integral, let's define this integral as some I which depends on gamma. In this first case, I gamma is basically the flux of this vector through this line here. So this I gamma is called the flux. And in the second case, where we measure the tangent component of this vector f, this would be called the circulation or the work done by this force F.
Sorry?
Yes.
So does the capital F have two different definitions in A and B?
Yes. These are two different definitions, yeah. So we will consider these two different scenarios. Do you want me to put a small a as an index of small f? Yes. So let's put a small a and a small b. So these are two different definitions. Okay?
Capital F is the same thing.
Sorry?
Capital F is just some function.
Yeah, this is any some function. So, to get an idea of what these quantities are, we will split this region of integration into small squares. And consider what would this contour integral be when we consider one of these squares. So what would be I for a small square? If the contour instead of being this gamma would be a small square. Okay? Now, it's easy to see. If you are in a very small region, this function here that you are integrating, you can compute it at this line, you can expand the function here is related by its derivative. And you can easily compute, let me write the result, and if someone is puzzled on how to arrive here, we can discuss it in more detail. In case A, we would say that this integral would be the divergence of this vector field times the area of the small square. While in case B, we would say this would be the curl of this vector field times the area of the small square. Okay? Is this clear to everyone? I will just compute. This is, of course, at a given point, there is a point in space-time. So I call it x. This is, of course, at x.
Does the orientation matter?
Yes.
Orientation.
Oh, okay, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Good. That's good that Colin pointed out. My orientation in this picture was the opposite of the orientation here. So let me use the same orientation. Sorry. It should be like this. Okay. So if this is clear for everyone, then we conclude that this integral here, since I can think of this integral here, if around the square it is just given by this, I can write this contour integral as thinking of the sum of squares, because whenever I have a square, the contribution from these two neighboring squares, they cancel out. So I have up here, down here. Let me zoom. I have up in one direction, down in the other direction, and this cancel. So the contour integral around the full contour, I can write it as a sum of the contour integrals of the squares, and therefore this flux is the integral around this region R of the divergence of my field F dA, whereas this one is the integral over the region R of the curl of my vector N dA. Okay? And this would be what I would call, what people call Stokes' theorem. And this here is what one calls, I always forget which one is who. Actually, I confuse. This is Stokes, and this is Gauss' theorem. Okay? So, now let's consider. So these are just some basic results about this contour integral. Let's consider here, of course, I must be a bit more specific. It's a complex. So this is a scalar. Here I mean the z component of this guy. So dot, let's say that this will be the z component of this. Now, how is this related to complex analysis? How is this related to thinking about analytic functions, about a function of z, where z is x plus I, y? Okay? Now, a function, which is a function of z, is not a function of z bar, right? Where z bar would be x minus I, y. So of course, by definition, the derivative with respect to z bar of a function of z is equal to zero. Right? But the derivative of a function, so what we do, so let's do the following. Let's split this function of z as its real part, which we call u, which depends on x and y, plus I times its imaginary part v, which depends on x and y. So this condition that the derivative with respect to z bar of f is equal to zero translates into dx minus I dy of u plus iv equal to zero. Actually, plus I dy. Okay? Is it clear that the sign here should be plus and not minus when I have derivative with respect to z bar? I want the derivative to kill z, right? So it's obvious that this should be the sign. Right? Dx of x is 1, I dy of iy is minus 1, and I get 0. And this condition, when I split again into its real and imaginary part, is equivalent. So saying that, let's see, dx of u, the real part, minus dy of v equal to 0, and dx of v plus dy of u equal to 0. So we see that for any complex function, we can define a vector field F, which is V and U. And these conditions here, which are called the Cauchy equations, are equivalent to saying that this vector F is divergence and kern 3. Okay? That is the divergence of this vector f. Can I still write here? No? Yes?
Sorry, why is the derivative with respect to z bar 0? Why did we decide that?
You have a function of z. So it doesn't depend on z bar. So in general, you have a function of z and z bar. And if you want, this is what an holomorphic function is. It's a function which only depends on z and not on z bar. So we might decide to pick to study this class of functions, so which are called holomorphic functions, functions which only depend on z. So if you have a function of a single variable, say a function of x, which is defined on the real axis, the natural way to promote it to a function which lives in the full complex plane is to say that x can be a complex number as well, right? So when you do this trivial operation, what you are doing is promoting x to z, if you want. Okay? Yes?
How do we know that d of z bar is dx plus I dy?
Yeah, if you want, this follows from one thing that you want dz bar of z to be equal to 0, dz bar of z bar equal to 1, right? So this probably means that the derivative there is some 1/2 factor, but it's proportional to this. Yeah, there might be a 1/2 to get the derivative of with respect to z bar to be 1. Probably I want the 1/2 here, which doesn't affect the argument, right? Okay, very good. Yeah, ask lots of questions, please. Please always ask questions. So why is f divergence and curl free? The divergence of f is dxv plus dyu equal to 0. It's exactly this condition. And the curl free is condition that dx of u minus dy of v equal to 0. Right? So to think about curl, normally we think that there is a third component which is 0. So let's repeat. F of z holomorphic is equivalent to divergence of f equal curl of f equal to 0, where f equal v plus I, equal v equal mu, and here f of z is equal to the real part plus I, the imaginary part. Okay? So this is interesting. We can build an interesting zero, which is an integral around the path of a quantity whose divergence and curl is 0. If the divergence and curl is 0, the integral around the path of both this quantity and this quantity are 0. Right? Because this quantity f, if f has no divergence and no curl, its integral, both its tangent component and its normal component around the curve, is 0. Right? Because they give the divergence and the curl inside of it. So let's build this 0, which I would call integral of this vector, v and y dotted with x dot y dot ds. Let's put an I. This would be the analog in that language of the part with t plus integral of v and u dot, now the tangent vector, the normal vector, which would be minus y dot x dot, which is orthogonal to the curve, ds, right, when I'm introducing some x of s and y of s to do this integral, and this would be the normal part, both of them are equal to 0, because the quantity is divergent and curl free. But this is nothing, and I leave it, and you can easily check, this is nothing but the integral around gamma of f of z of s, z dot of s, ds, when you write z as x plus yi, which is what we define, this is what we mean by the symbol integral around gamma f of z dz. Okay, so integral of f in a region, in a loop gamma, where everything is smooth, where there are no particular surprises waiting us inside, where the divergence and the curl are really zero, in other words, where there are no singularities here, is equal to zero. And this is what's called Cauchy's theorem. That tells you that the integral of complex function around a closed contour, if the function is regular, is equal to zero. Okay? Any questions here? Of course, everyone knows this result, right? Everyone knows that we can integrate analytic functions around loops. And if the function is smooth, the result is zero. Okay. As I told you, this will be mostly review, hopefully told in a way which is a bit different than what you have seen, just so that it's not infinitely boring. S will be some real parameter parameterizing the curve, yeah. So I will write the curve. My curve is parameterized by x of s, y of s, and I will write it in that way. Okay, good. So this, of course, implies that if I consider instead the integral on the complex plane from a point z1 to z2, the integral along this curve, let's call this gamma, and let's suppose another contour here is gamma prime. Of course, the integral on gamma of f of z dz is equal to the integral on gamma prime of f of z dz, because the difference of the two is a contour, is a closed contour. Now, is this result completely obvious, a priori? I mean, is this something that we should actually have expected, and is it just something completely obvious and geometrical? The answer is yes. So let's see how we can understand this in an even more straightforward way. So here is our function. Let's draw, say, its real part, or its imaginary part, doesn't matter. So we have some function. Let's call this the origin. Let's think this is 0, 0. And we have our function somewhere here. In some region of the complex plane. And the function is analytic. It's well-behaved. So here is x and y, and here is something, for example, real part of f or whatever. Now, around this point here, since the function is analytic, for all practical purposes, this f of z is equal to a polynomial of some high degree, right? N is large. Right? If I zoom a lot, it looks like a plane. Otherwise, I start to see the curvature. So if I choose the degree of the polynomial to be large enough, I approximate the function around the origin in some region here. Okay? If you want, I can put approximately equal, but you understand what I mean. I mean that you put some epsilons, n goes to infinity, blah, blah. Yeah? Okay. So it's a polynomial. So it's given by some c0 plus some c1z plus some c2z squared plus etc. And I want to understand the following question. If I have a polynomial, and if I have the origin here, and I want to pick many points around the origin, at some fixed distance r, say, and I want to ask myself, what's the average of this polynomial, pn, on those points? If I compute the polynomial at all those points and take the average. What is this average equal to? Now it's extremely hot again. Callum, do you mind turning it up? OK, good. So let's start with one of those terms, one of the terms of the polynomial. Of course, the average is linear. So let's start with, say, z cube. And let's consider 4 points. So let's start with z to the cube and 4 points. So I pick 4 points. So here are they. 1, 2, 3, 4. Here is the origin. Right? Let this distance here be r. And what are these points mapped to when I map them under z to the cube? So let's map again the origin here. The first point is at a distance r cubed, right? And all other points, they will be in this circle of radius r cubed. Right? Let's use some colors. I'm sorry that if you don't have colors. So this first point went here. Now the second point, where will it go? Where will this one go? So this is the original angle. I make it cubed, so 1 times, 2 times. So this point goes here. Right? This other point, 1, 2, 3, would go here again. And this last point would go here. Okay? So the average would amount to summing these 4 vectors here. And if I have more points, I would sum in general a star with even more edges, right? And of course, the sum of all these directions cancels out and I get 0. So the average of some z to some power, if I pick large enough number of points, is 0, because I just, when taking the average, the points are pointing in all possible directions and they just cancel out. When I take this map, if I would consider more points, I would just get more points here and they would cancel out against each other. So the average of a polynomial of degree n is just the constant, the only one which survives, which is the average of the polynomial at the origin. Okay? And I am, of course, assuming that the number of points is becoming very large, much larger than the degree of the polynomial. Okay? Of course, this is obvious. This is just a statement that the integral, if I go to the continuum limit, d theta over 2 pi, e to the 2 pi, e to the I n theta is equal to delta n comma 0. Okay? So this means that if I average a function, if I average a regular function around the circle, I get the value of the regular function on the origin. Okay? So this means that the integral d theta over 2 pi f at r e to the I theta is equal to f of 0. Okay? Before making contact with what we have seen before, first of all, is someone surprised by the fact that we have a closed contour here and we are not getting 0? No one should be, because this is not an integral dz, right? It's an integral d theta. I'm averaging over thetas. If I would write to go to dz, I would have to change variables from z to theta. So this doesn't contradict this. We will soon see the relation between these two boxes, but notice that this one doesn't contradict this one. Okay? Now we can generalize a bit. We can think that our function is not regular. It might have poles, for example, inside this contour. So far, any question here? I hope everything is clear. So now, Okay, before generalizing to non-regular functions, let's emphasize again what we have shown. We have shown that integral, the average of f of z on a circle of radius r is f at the origin. And I could, of course, compute this average both for the real part and for the imaginary part. Right? I could have decomposed this average here. I could write f to be u plus iv. And I would get here u plus iv at the origin. And u and v are the real and the imaginary part of the function. By definition, they are real functions. So I would conclude also that the average of this u of x and y, notice it's a function of the two variables, at some region r is equal to u at the origin, and similarly for v. At some radius r is equal to v at the origin. So this is what is called Gauss mean theorem. So we see that functions, when averaged around a circle, give the value of functions at the origin. Now, not any function of x and y, of course. So what is special about this u and v as functions of two variables? Sorry? Yeah. So as Eduardo said, right? So as Eduardo said, and as we will soon see, this is not true for any function. So as we have seen, this is true for analytic functions. And we will see that these functions, u and v, we'll see in a couple of minutes, are particular functions within the family of functions of two variables, which are called harmonic functions. It's functions which you are tired of studying in electromagnetism, as we will see soon. And for harmonic functions, it's also true that the average of harmonic functions is the value of the function of the origin. Okay, let me tell you what an harmonic function is, otherwise it looks a bit stupid. So, we have seen that harmonic functions means that the second derivative with respect to x plus second derivative with respect to y of u equal to zero, and similar for v. Why is this true? Why do we get, for any holomorphic function, for any analytic function of f of z, how did we get, for free, functions which obey some differential equation? And the reason is that they obey Cauchy equations, right? du of x equal dx of u equal dv of y, etc. And this follows trivially. If you try to compute one of these terms, you get zero, from Cauchy equations. Okay? So if you plug Cauchy equations and you use them, you arrive at this conclusion. So we see that holomorphic functions, f of z, they generate harmonic functions. It's trivial to generate harmonic functions. You pick a function, say cosine of x, you promote x to z, you get cosine of x plus yz. Then you split imaginary and real parts, and you got two harmonic functions. Right? Again, you pick some function of z, any function, 1 over z squared plus 1, you write z to x plus y I plus iy, you separate the real and the imaginary part, and this gives you two harmonic functions. So f of z generates, in a trivial way, harmonic functions. Of course, yeah, okay. That's it. So now, let's generalize a bit and consider the case where f of z is not regular. Let's consider the case where we have some spike in our curve. Okay? Some singularity here. That is, I want to consider my function f of z. It's no longer true that it is a polynomial, but in general, if this would be the origin, let's suppose that there's only one singularity inside, the generalization will be obvious. F of z will be some sum, okay, let me write, it will be some dot 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 plus c minus 2 over z square plus c minus 1 over z plus c naught plus c1z plus c2z square plus dot dot dot. That is, I can have now positive powers of z and negative powers of z. If the singularity is a pole of degree 5, this is the most singular that a function is. It's 1 over z to the 5. If I factor 1 over z to the 5, then the rest is regular and I have an expansion in positive powers of z. Right? So the function starts at the most singular point, at the most singular power, and then it goes on in principle forever. Yes?
Why we don't consider non-integer powers?
Because we are moving step by step. Tomorrow we will consider non-integer powers. Yeah? To consider non-integer powers, you need more imagination. Cosines, sines, Lorentzians, they are only integer powers. We will deal with square roots tomorrow. Okay, good. So today we are not powerful enough for square roots. So now, what would be the integral? Okay, what would be the average in the sense of integral d theta over 2 pi of f of r e to the I theta? What is this? I would say it's again extremely cold. I'm sorry. Yeah, so what is this? The argument's exactly the same as there. Nothing changes in that blackboard. Okay, so let me nominate a volunteer. So what is it? Equal to? What's your name? Ravel?
Neva.
So now let's pick each of these powers. What's the average of each of them?
I have a singular point at 0.
See, at 0 this term explodes. But let's compute the average of this term here, 1 over z squared. Okay? So you want to compute the average of 1 over z squared. So you do the same thing. You pick 1 over z squared and you consider points around 0. Right? Now each of these points, if you consider many of them, will point in different directions, right? The only difference in this argument is that here, instead of this radius being r to the 3, this radius, it would be r to the minus 3 if I would be doing this argument for z to the minus 3 instead of z cubed. Otherwise, this picture would be exactly the same, right? The only difference is that this point here, which is the point at r, is mapped to a point r to the minus 3. Okay, so this length, instead of being bigger, it's a bit smaller if r is bigger than 1. But still, the points cancel out completely. When you average, right, they cancel. So the point that all these powers here, they still cancel when I average, when I sum over them, and I am left just with c naught again. Or if you want, from this argument here, this n need not be positive. So it would be, again, delta n 0. Yeah? Yes. Yes. So that the average of 1 is 1. Right? The average of 1 better be 1, right? So I divide by 2 pi, so that the integral of 1. So this is what I define as average of f. Of course, here, okay, yeah, this is what I define as average of f at some radius r. And the average of 1 is 1. In the discrete, I would write 1 over n, sum over n points, so that the average of 1 is 1 again. Now, this condition is equivalent to, now let's make a jump to make contact with this thing here. Let's consider the integral around the circle of dz over 2 pi I f of z. What is it equal to? What is this integral equal to? How would you do? Suppose you did not know. Of course, you know what an integral of a function with poles is around the origin, right? But suppose you didn't know and you only wanted to do this, to use this result. What would you do?
You write zeta as r t I.
Good. What's your name? Anton. Yeah. So as Anton said, we write z as r e to the I theta. So that dz would be r I e to the I theta d theta, which is nothing but I z d theta. Okay. So this integral is equal to our favorite average, d theta over 2 pi, from 0 to 2 pi, of the function f of z times z. What is the c naught of this function? Someone except Anton. If you multiply the function by z, this c1 becomes the guy who multiplies z squared. C minus 1, right? So this is nothing but c minus 1. And c minus 1, which is the coefficient of the function when I expand 1 over z, this is what is called the residue of f of z at z equal to 0. Now, as we saw, the contour of integration, the loop, the particular loop we choose is irrelevant. It doesn't matter. Here I chose z equal to r. It's a particular, very nice, beautiful circle. I could put some waves there and twist it a bit. What we conclude, therefore, is that the integral dz over 2 pi I over some funny contour with some singularities. Now, these are pole singularities. Okay. This would be the sum, let's say in this case we have 1, 2, up to m, sum from j equal 1 up to m, the residue of the function f of z at z equal to zj. Okay? So f of z close to zj behaves as the residue of f over c minus zj. Okay? Behaves not in the sense that this is the most singular behavior, but in the sense that in the expansion this term is there. Okay? Let's be careful. This symbol means this term appears in the expansion. Right? In this sense here. Yeah, of course. Good. So, of course, this box here is just a particular consequence of this one here, right? If there are no residues, if there are no singularities inside our contour of integration, then, of course, we get 0 on the right-hand side. Okay. Is this completely clear for everyone? Or is someone confused? Please ask now. This is extremely important for what follows. Okay? So, of course, the simple consequence of this is that the integral dz over 2 pi I of f of z over z minus a equal to f of a, if we are integrating around a contour gamma which encircles A, and if f of z is analytic inside gamma. Right? If we have a function which is analytic, and we want to know the value at some particular point inside some contour A, we just need to compute this integral. Yes. Yes. Around zj.
So you
are building the expansion of f of z around z equals zj. So let me write it. So it has, yeah, there are many points. Around a particular point, the function has a singularity, right? So around such points, around one such point, your function. Yes. Yeah. As in one expansion, around one of the points. Around one of the points, I don't care that far away there is another point. So around that point, my f of z is given by, again, some c minus 2 z minus zj squared plus c minus 1 z minus zj. Let's call it, I'm not c, but d. It's not the same, of course. Plus d0 plus d1 z minus zj plus etc. Close to each point, this is the correct expression. Right? It captures, if you are expanding around the point, the function doesn't know that there is another singularity a bit far away. Right? So I focus around one such point. This point here is far away.
But in the expansion, you still have to find that other residue somewhere.
Yeah. So at each point when I know there is a singularity, I expand the function. I read what is d minus 1. And I sum all the d minus 1s. So if I know that there are three singularities, I need to expand the function three times. One around each singularity. Around each singularity, I compute the d. And then I sum the d's. Right? Yes?
Sorry, what is the definition of residue?
Residue is the coefficient of the simple pole in the expansion. Now, please ask more questions if you have them. This is something I find absolutely, if you think of it, it's really amazing how this works. So if you have a function and you know the function here only, I give you a bunch of data, table, and I only know the function in a particular contour. You know nothing about the function inside, about the function outside. You only know the function here, and you want to know the function here. It's spectacular that to know the function here, you only need to know data of the function on some loop which surrounds that data. It doesn't even matter which contour it is. So if you want to know the function here, this f of a is just the integral on the region where we have data to know what the function is, dz over 2 pi I, f of z over, if you want the complex distance between the point A and the point z on the region where we know the function. It's really quite spectacular that functions, when I naively replace x by a complex number, they have this spectacular property. That in the complex plane, I just need to know the function on some loop if I want to know it in some point inside that loop. It's really something deep and spectacular about the complex plane. If you want. Okay. An obvious consequence of this is that suppose I want to pick this d minus 2, or suppose I want to pick, let's say here I have d1 z minus zj plus d2 z minus zj squared plus etc. Suppose I want to pick this d2, right? I'm giving the function on a given contour gamma, and I want to know the second derivative of the function at A. Can I do it? How would I compute the second derivative of the function at A? Now I don't want the value. I don't want this d minus 1. I want the second derivative of the function. Suppose this is what I aim at this point A. Zj is A. So not someone who already answered. Yes?
By the cube?
Absolutely. I would divide by the cube. So if I would now compute the integral dz over 2 pi I f of z over z minus a to the power to the cubed power, right? If f of z is equal to, okay, if f of z contains this term dz minus a cubed plus tak tak tak, this function here is a function which has exactly, sorry, square. This f of z over z minus a cube has precisely dot 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 plus d over z minus a plus dot dot dot. So what was the coefficient of z square is now the single pole. So of course this will give me precisely this d here. So just being given the function, not the derivative, just I'm just giving the function f on some loop g, on some loop gamma, and I can know any derivative by just playing with the powers of z minus a. In this case, I put z minus a cubed. It means that the term dz minus a squared becomes d over z minus a. And therefore, the integral of this function gives the residue, which is just d. Right? So I can probe any derivative of f by just playing with contour integrals in some contour where I'm given the function to some power. Okay. Can we turn the air conditioning on? Sorry. Thank you, Cal. Okay. Now, this is not the derivative, the second derivative of the function, right? This is the second derivative up to a factor of 2. And if I would have a fourth derivative, so in general there is an n factorial there if you want to replace d by second derivative of the function at a. Okay. So let's see a couple of consequences of what we have seen so far. So any question here? Is this equation clear to everyone? Is it clear to everyone that this box here? This is quite important. It should be clear to everyone, I hope. Okay. But think a bit if there's something you don't understand in the blackboards. And if there is, ask, please. Okay. Now, if you give me some function f of z, we saw that we can get a function x u of x and y plus I v and x of y just by picking this function and splitting the real and imaginary part of the function. And each of these functions was harmonic. Right? So the second derivative with respect to x plus second derivative with respect to y of u was equal to 0, and the same thing for v. Okay? Now let's think the other way around. Let's suppose that this is our starting point. We are given an harmonic function. Someone hands us an harmonic function. Okay? So I have a u, which is harmonic. Can I get an analytic function f of z? Is there a unique way of starting from an harmonic function u, only u, not u and v, only u? Can I go back and, in a more or less unique way, tell you what is the analytic function which generates this u and, as a bonus, a v, which is also an harmonic function. Okay? And of course I can, because given u, what are the equations for v? The equations for v are dxu equal dyv, these were the Cauchy equations, and dyu equal, and minus dyu equal dxv. Right? Just first order differential equations. So of course if I am given u and v, I can completely compute, if I am given u as function of x and y, I can compute v by just integrating these equations. And this, of course, gives me v up to a constant. Right? The constant I cannot see. I take derivatives of that constant, I get zero. So the map is indeed that given an holomorphic function, we get f of z up to an imaginary constant. Imaginary because it belongs to v. Let's see how this works for one example which makes it clear. Let's consider the simplest possible holomorphic function, which would be u of x and y equal to x. X clearly is a harmonic function. Right? Second derivative of x is 0, and it doesn't even depend on y. Okay? So example. U of x and y equal to x.
Sorry.
Yes?
Is this a complex constant or imaginary constant?
Imaginary constant, yeah.
Pure imaginary.
Purely imaginary because the functions v and u are real functions by definition, right? I decompose a function f as real and imaginary parts. So of course, u and v are real functions. So when I integrate in v, I am allowed to add real constants only. And because v is multiplied by I, it's an imaginary constant. Okay? So by definition of real, and what I mean by this decomposition, these are real functions. Okay? So let u of x and y be x. Then we have that the derivative with respect to x of u is equal to 1. The derivative with respect to y of u is equal to 0, and this is the derivative with respect of x of v, and this is the derivative with respect to y of v. Okay? Okay. And this means, from this equation, that I have a function v which doesn't depend on x, and the derivative with respect to y is 1. So, of course, v of x and y doesn't depend on x, only depends on y. The derivative is 1. It's y plus a constant. And therefore, our function f of z is just the function z plus I, that constant. Okay? You can play a bit with more complicated functions if you want. Yes?
Don't you require the reason you're going over to be like super connected in order to do this?
Yes, I require that. But everything I've said so far is about simply connected regions. So, do you have in mind square roots now?
No, I mean, because if your region isn't simply connected, then you can't necessarily take a path over.
Yeah, but for now I'm considering functions which are in a complex plane, which is just a plane, and it's simply connect. Good. So, more questions? Yeah. Now, so, this is something remarkable about functions in general, these Cauchy equations. In spirit, they are very similar to what might surprise us about these kind of results should also surprise us about these kind of equations. This equation tells us that if you know the function in some region, we can use these differential equations to propagate and to know the function elsewhere. Right? If you are given the function in some region, and in some region you know x and you know u and v, then the rest of the function outside that region is governed by a differential equation. There are differential equations which govern how the function varies when you go, when you increase y and when you increase x. So given the function in some region, so this is where we know some, where we know some the values of some function f of z. Okay, again, imagine some table of data. I can enlarge this region. I can enlarge this region by using Cauchy equations. Okay? I can, in principle, use Cauchy equations to increase my knowledge of the function. We can even take it to the extreme. Suppose I know the function. Let's try to see how powerful this can be. Suppose I know the function, not even in a region, but just in a line. Okay? Suppose I know the function in a segment, in a finite segment. There is some point A, some point B, and here we know U and V. Okay? For simplicity, let's assume that this is the, here is X, here is Y. Okay? We know the function in some segment here. Of course, the argument doesn't depend on the fact that the segment is horizontal. Then, the derivative of the function y with respect to y of u, say, is equal to the derivative of x of v. Okay? Which means that if I have my function which is defined in this line, a, b, and if I'm plotting, say, v here, okay, and I see that v here is growing, there is this positive derivative here, this tells me, if I am in this point, okay, this will tell me how to go in this direction and how to know u here. U here, the u grows by an amount which is the same amount by which v is growing in this segment. So if I give you u and v in this segment, if you know v in this segment, and you look at a particular point of this segment and see v is growing at 2 meters per second in this segment, or whatever, it has derivative 2. It means that u, the real part, grows also with that velocity in the imaginary direction. So it means that I know what the value of u is in a nearby point here. And in this way, I could construct the values of u and of v in all these points here. And then I don't know, no, I no longer know only in a segment, I know in a segment and in a nearby segment. And in this way, I can in principle continue and know the function everywhere. Okay? So in principle, if there are no obstructions or if there are no subtleties, which we will see in one or two lectures, this is enough. A segment is enough. Which is quite spectacular. So if I give you a function, just a small segment, and I tell you how the imaginary part and the real part behave on that segment, I can then use Cauchy equations to know the function everywhere. So if it's something holographic or whatever. I know the function in just a small segment, and I know it everywhere. Okay, so you start to understand. So of course it's very clear that this is a powerful way of generating non-trivial results. So of course then people are amazed, because I know the function here. Immediately I deduce that the function somewhere else is equal to zero or whatever. Everything looks then mysterious once you start using this stuff, because there are miracles like this everywhere. Okay, I think now it's a good place for a break, and then we would start using Mathematica as an application of what we have seen so far. Yeah, good.